So if we understand something about our knowledge of God, it changes the way we might approach others. If we have a sensitivity to the fact that our knowledge of God comes to us in two differing modes, it'll help us to strategize and know our abilities, but also to know our limitations. And so, without further ado, this will be the practical tips from Thomas Aquinas. And I'll actually give you these in terms of a list, just, you know, a numbered list. If St. Thomas was writing for a blog, this is how he would, you know, 8 tips for talking to your friends about God from Thomas Aquinas. So here it is. Tip number 1, begin with common ground. We always want to begin with what we have in common with someone. And this, you know, seems obvious, but something we often forget. We like to stress difference. You know, even in our own sort of small talk conversations, I'm not the best at small talk. So I recognize this as a limitation in myself. But, you know, you say, oh, where are you from? Okay, what do you do? What do you do? And then as soon as the person says what they do and I understand nothing about it, I think, oh, okay, great. And, you know, a lot of small talk is actually spent trying to find something you can both talk about. And so similarly, when we're talking about God, or at least getting to a point in the conversation where God comes up, it presupposes actually a lot of natural interaction. And a lot of things are about finding that common ground. How is this going to change our approach? What are the various points of agreement we might already share? Well, if we're arguing with another Catholic about God, this would be interesting, but we do it, I think. There's a great deal we have in common. We have all of sacred scripture and tradition. We have the teaching as given to us through the apostolic tradition, through the church. Now, if we're talking to a non-Catholic Christian about God, we have the scriptures completely at our disposal, even if they, you know, reject any notion of tradition or any notion of the authority of the church, well, we still have the scriptures to work with, and that's quite a bit. The Old and New Testaments, you know, if there's a particular teaching that they take issue with, you know, I mean, there are many Catholics out there who have had long conversations with Protestant friends about the Eucharist, and they very often, those Catholics, go to John chapter 6 to really highlight our Lord's words about what he's really doing, really intending to do in instituting the Eucharist. That's just an example. Let's say we have someone, a friend who's Jewish, and we're talking to them about God. Well, they might, then we actually have all of the Old Testament in common that we could really talk about. Just to, you know, let's not underestimate what we actually already share in common. And then let's say we're talking to someone who's Muslim. Then you have a profound sense of revelation that they have. And also, there's a great deal about God we agree on, about the unity of God and many of his qualities. So there's a fair amount of common ground. Okay, so I went through all of those rather quickly. They really deserve their own workshop, as it were. But you may have guessed already that I'm intending to focus on those coming from a very secular background, those who are, for lack of a better word, practical atheists, or who are agnostics of some sort. So you might think to yourself, well, what do I have in common with them when it comes to God? And this is one of the important things that Thomas does, is help us realize how much we actually have in common. There's at least the common ground of reason. And that's part of why I spent so much time kind of laying out the different modes of our knowledge. And if you read that quote at the beginning of the second section, you'll see, quote, if our opponent believes nothing of divine revelation, there's no longer any means of proving the articles of faith by reasoning, but only of answering his objections, if he has any, against faith. So if you think about it, it's actually good when people have objections. You have something you can work with. You know, you might think, oh, this person, well, they have all of these objections to faith. Well, thank goodness they've been thinking about it, you know. They can formulate something they're uncomfortable with. That's actually a good position to start. So, moving on to number 2, and we'll see, I put these in a certain order because they kind of flow. Tip number 2, don't be afraid to present arguments. Our culture is increasingly uncomfortable with disagreement. Think of how negative the word argument actually sounds. Well, we had an argument, you know, the tone that has, the negative connotation that has. But really, in the basic sense, an argument is neutral. It's just a presentation of a sequence of reasoning. So a lesson we could all learn from philosophers is to not take arguments personally. Many people feel argument has no place in life, and certainly not when it comes to a discussion of God or religion. And this is unfortunate, because we can formulate arguments to demonstrate the preambles of the faith. We can argue that God exists, and that he's one, and good, and created the world out of nothing, and guides creation. Everything else in that category that I have there spelled out for you on the chart. If you think of it in row 3 there, all of those things are things you could discuss and have someone see the profound reasonability of, even apart from religious faith. It's a different way of looking at it than we typically think. No? So going back to Father Sebastian's story about Fulton Sheen and Mortimer Adler, there's often that point in the conversation where someone says, oh, well, I just don't have faith, so I can't see what you see. We can actually turn around with Aquinas' help and say, well, actually, these are things that I think you can come to at least a basic notion of without faith. Not saying it's necessarily the way it needs to be for you, because typically most people do come to know these truths through faith, but at least in principle, they're things that one could know by reason alone. So it'd be wonderful if everyone could study philosophy, but for some obvious reasons, not everyone can make this a serious occupation. So even if you can't really delve into the substance of the proofs for God's existence, it's still a good idea to acquaint yourself with the general idea. And in fact, it's the general idea that people really need. It's really all they really need at times. To put it technically, we could say it this way, that enthymemes are often more persuasive than syllogisms. You could say, I can handle one new word in a sentence at a time, but not two. Why did you do that to me? Syllogisms are very tight arguments that we sort of produce one by one to build up an argument in a very tight philosophical way. But they're kind of hard on the ears, and they require us to go through over and over again. So a strict demonstration of God's existence, or that God is one, or that the world depends on God for its existence, this is something, yes, that a philosopher is going to need to, if he's going to argue for this, going to need to present it in a very tight way in a syllogistic form. But if he's just talking to his friend, you know, he can use enthymemes. And that's where we just kind of make an argument to the general effect, but we might leave out some of the details because they're implied. You know, if you think about it, and in actually coming here on the subway, there was one of the you know, subway trains was honked its horn very loud, and this little girl goes, Daddy, what's that? You know, or why? Again, we all question the causes. And the dad says, oh, well, someone must have been on the platform. And you think to yourself, okay, if I'm a child, that doesn't necessarily follow, that doesn't make sense. Okay, there's a horn. Okay, well, someone's on the platform. The unspoken premise in there is that, well, if someone's on the platform, the driver may be concerned that they're going to hit them, and so they honk their horn to warn them. There's all of that in there, you know? If we were to really tease out the details, we'd have to put all of those little reasonings in there. My point in going into this is not to give you a lesson in logic, but to show you that we don't need to necessarily have the tightest of arguments available on our fingertips, on the tip of our tongue. But in a way, we can express the general idea and cause people to begin to really question, to raise some of the ultimate questions in their mind. So Aquinas famously gives 5 proofs for God's existence, and I'm not going to go into all of them. But I would like, because I promised you to talk a little bit about the proofs for God's existence, just go through a kind of, let's say, broad summary. And this is something, actually, that I wrote recently for an RCIA program that the Thomistic Institute is producing. And it's the first chapter, talking about the existence of God, and this is just a paragraph from there. What would it be if we were to try to summarize the general idea of St. Thomas's proofs for God? So not everyone's able to understand his proofs, but you can understand the basic point, I think. So here we go. By looking at the things God has done, we can learn something about him. We can move from his effects to the cause, who is God himself. We look at the world, and we see that something exists rather than nothing. Just looking out our bedroom window, we may see all sorts of things, rocks and grass and trees and dogs and clouds. If we're in New York, we may not see a lot of grass, but we will see a lot of dogs. I just added that part right now. We also can look into our own selves and reflect upon the little universe within, our inner self. And sometimes we have the privilege to gaze on beautiful and mind-blowing things like mountains and oceans and stars. And so there must be something greater than all these things, something more powerful and intelligent than all of us. Think of an artist and a piece of art he creates. Even the greatest pieces of art are not as impressive as the thinking and feeling human beings who made them. No matter how beautiful you think Mona Lisa is, you know that Da Vinci himself, while he may not have been as beautiful as her, was more impressive as a thinking and feeling human being. Likewise, Michelangelo had a much greater dignity than the colossal statue of David he sculpted. In a similar way, we can reason that God is greater than his works. He is the very, quote, author of beauty, in the words of the Book of Wisdom, the creator of the beautiful things of this world. God surpasses his creation infinitely more than an artist surpasses his works. Because artists always begin with some material, such as canvas or paint or stone, but God creates out of nothing. And with his almighty power, he calls into existence the things that do not exist. That's from Romans. Every artist leaves his mark, too. And God's mark is most basic. He's given things existence. He is the one who exists in the fullest sense. As he put it to Moses in Exodus, "I am who am." And the works of God also aren't mere static figures like a painting or a sculpture. And from this we know that God doesn't exist as a static or impersonal force, but that he's personal, living, and intelligent. He is preeminent and superabundant life, who, quote, in the words of Acts, gives to all men life and breath and everything. And so that's not a very strict argument, but it is a way to sort of paint not only the existence of God and arguments for it, generally moving in that direction, but also to discuss some of God's attributes. And there's a way in which various proofs for God's existence can kind of direct us towards various attributes for God as well. So that's a general idea, that what I just described to you wouldn't hold up necessarily as a strict logical form, but it might be, you know, something that's persuasive to someone reading it for the first time. Or you might grasp the sense of that and be able to put it in your own words to your friend, which is in a way more important than being able to repeat the argument in the strict sense. Okay, tip number 3, and this is a short one. Know the limits of argument. Arguments, as we saw, can't prove the mysteries of the faith. For instance, and this is St. Thomas's typical example, you can't prove the mystery of the Trinity. I'm getting you all ready for Father John Baptist's presentation in March, coming to talk about the mystery of the Trinity. Something is only, that the Trinity is something only knowable through supernatural faith, and so that requires grace. Tip number 4, have confidence in the truth. This is one of the most important points, and I think, you know, in a way, the whole reason for giving this presentation, one of the main reasons at least. And this is that we can talk to anyone about God, regardless of the religious experiences that they've had. We have the truth and human nature's innate receptivity to truth on our side. We also have natural curiosity, the natural curiosity of human nature on our side. Human beings look for causes, you know. The child, hearing a loud noise, says, "What's that?" And doesn't just say, "Huh, I guess it's a big loud noise." We look for causes. And so, in terms of our own position, we have actually the upper ground. If we introduce God to people, we're introducing someone that they've been expecting in one way or another. And although we can't prove the mysteries of the faith through arguments, we can defend them with arguments. We can show that there's nothing contradictory in them. We can show forth their intelligibility. For example, to take the basic example again of the Trinity, someone might say, well, how can God be three and one? That's a contradiction. And so we would naturally respond, we're not saying that God is three and one in the same respect, but there's three persons in one divine nature. And that's not proving anything to respond that way. We're not proving anything, strictly speaking. And it's true, there's a lofty mystery we need to behold in contemplating the Holy Trinity. There's something inexhaustible there, something that our minds will never completely comprehend, but yes, something we'll understand more and more, especially with the beatific vision. We could go on, of course. How could God become man? Someone might ask us. Well, if he's God, he can't be man. He says, well, we're not saying that God, now I need to be very careful. We're saying that Christ is one person and two natures, a human and divine. We can kind of spell out the terms of what exactly we're claiming. Now, that's not the same as proving it. There's still going to need to be a supernatural activity of faith in the mind and heart of someone in order for them to believe those mysteries. And I mention these two mysteries too, because they're the two that St. Thomas says we should always hold before our minds. He writes in his prologue to the Compendium of Theology, which is addressed to Reginald, and he says, always hold these before your mind, the Trinity and the Incarnation, the divinity of Christ, as the kind of two axes on which our faith turns. So this is where it gets delicate, too. So bear with me, but it's all going to pay out in our confidence in the truth. So to go back to that first quote of part two, so St. Thomas says, well, if someone doesn't believe divine revelation, we can't necessarily we can't use revelation to argue with them, really. But, and then this is the second part, since faith rests upon infallible truth, and since the contrary of a truth can never be demonstrated, it is clear that arguments brought against the faith cannot be demonstrations, but are difficulties that can be answered. That's a very consoling line. Arguments against the faith, objections to the faith, are difficulties that can be answered. And we don't always feel that way, right? We might, if someone objects to Christianity for X, Y, or Z reasons, we might say, oh no, I don't have an answer for them. But there's a difference between not having an answer there and then on the spot and there being no answer at all, right? So any objection brought against the faith is a difficulty that can be answered. So we can disprove, let's say, bad arguments or objections to the faith, or at the very least, we can show that they don't necessarily follow. And this is where St. Thomas, I think, gives us an incredible blank check, that we can have a great confidence in the truth. It's not like there's some argument lurking out there that could potentially bring down the whole Christian faith. We may not be able to answer someone's tough objections right away. We all have different abilities to do that, too. But we know that any objection to the Catholic faith is answerable. And often it's a matter of seeking out an answer for that person or directing them to someone who can answer their objection. Tip number five, realize that someone's objections to belief may be a substitute for something else. So people can often feel threatened by belief. And we see this, you know, that there's a hostility at times that immediately comes up. But if someone's reasons for not believing in God sound rather strange, it might be because they're masking a deeper problem, and the person may not even know this themselves. So we should never underestimate the power of the rational animal to make excuses. I have an interesting story, which I hope I can successfully make relevant in this context, but it's a fun story nonetheless. So, when I was in the novitiate, one of the brothers was like cleaning the wax out of candles, a very obnoxious task, and he accidentally cut himself. And so we had to rush him to the emergency room to get stitches for his hand. And so me and another brother were sitting in the waiting room in our habits, just pretending that nothing was awkward about all of this, you know? So here we are sitting, just two of us in the emergency room here, and this woman says, "Well, are you guys priests in training?" I said, "Well, yeah, something like that, yeah." And she says, "Oh, you know, I used to be Catholic, but then I heard about all those scandals. And then the church wouldn't help my mother. And so I said, well, two bad things with one religion, I'm not going to be Catholic anymore." And so you're thinking like, okay, what do I say next? Like, okay. And this woman from across the room says, "Oh, but you can't say that a whole religion's bad just because of a few experiences." And I'm like, "Yes, thank you. And then that same person says, "But I don't believe in any religion." So we tend to think that, you know, there's two camps. There's us and there's everyone else. No, but actually, everyone else doesn't necessarily agree with everyone else. And people can see through other people's arguments and objections, even if they themselves haven't been convinced by the truth in a complete way. I was just flabbergasted by the whole experience. And left speechless. But it shows us that, you know, I guess perhaps what I'm suggesting is, yes, while this woman may have had a bad experience with the church, it also may have been somewhat of a convenient excuse. So also we need to consider the reality of original sin and the fall. And we can understand all of this in light of the fall, that the fall resulted in ignorance, but also in weakness of the will. And I've given you a quote from Pius XII's Humani Generis, so this isn't a quote from Aquinas, but it's jives very well. So, the defects of the will often obscure the mind. Quote, "For though, absolutely speaking, human reason, by its own natural force and light, can arrive at a true and certain knowledge of the one personal God," what we were talking about in the first lecture, "still, there are not a few obstacles to prevent reason from making efficient and fruitful use of its natural ability. Now, the human intellect, in gaining knowledge of such truth, is hampered both by the activity of the senses and the imagination, and by evil passions arising from original sin. Hence, men easily persuade themselves in such matters that what they do not wish to believe is false, or at least doubtful." Could really just take that last sentence, that we easily persuade ourselves that such matters we do not wish to be or do not wish to believe are false or doubtful. So, in other words, the will, under the influence of the lower powers, can cloud the mind. It's sort of like looking through a dirty windshield where you can barely see where you're driving and there's no washer fluid left. And I think this is where a lot of people are at. Their problem isn't necessarily with God, but some kind of moral hang-up. And there may also be some theoretical arguments against Christianity that they use to protect themselves from the deeper consideration of God. They say, "Oh, well, there's been a lot of modern scientific findings, and I'm no scientist, but I'm pretty sure those disprove religion. So I'm going to learn a little bit about those as a way to sort of excuse myself from the obligation to consider the question of God more seriously and deeply." So in short, for various reasons, we're often inclined to believe whatever is more convenient for us instead of truths that will really challenge us. Coming to believe in God is a big, life-altering step for many. And believing that God exists leads quite naturally to other important considerations. What do I need to know to have a relationship with Him? Will He make me change my lifestyle? Will I have to leave some things behind? This is where the words of some of the demons that Jesus cast out, this was the in the reading for last Sunday, they say, "What have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? Have you come to destroy us?" No, I'm not comparing non-believers to demons, but I am saying that anyone can have that immediate reaction when they carefully consider what religion may entail for them, what following Christ may entail for them, and how believing in God may affect their own life and the way they live out their life. But we know that the truth liberates us, even if it stings at first. So, sort of in light of all of this, it's actually great news for us in talking to others about God and trying to persuade them to consider the question of God more seriously. It means we don't necessarily need to teach them all of philosophy or carefully build up one proposition of natural theology after another. Instead, as Aquinas suggests, all we really need to do is address their objections to belief. And a lot of other things will take care of themselves. Again, any objection we face is answerable, whether by showing it to be false or that it doesn't necessarily follow. I'm from Kansas, so time for a rural analogy. You know, when my father was mowing the pasture once, this makes me sound much like I grew up on a farm, which isn't exactly true, but when my father was mowing down the pasture once, and it was just full of weeds, hadn't been taken care of in years, and it had all of these nasty types of weeds that had grown up, and so he's on the big tractor and he's mowing it down with this you know, heavy duty tractor mower, and he says, "Well, it's my understanding that if you mow down all of the nasty weeds, the grass sort of, you know, grows up naturally after that." And it's true, that's certainly what happened, that it looked much better, and you had a kind of natural life that grew up from that. I think this is something we can use as an image. You know, sometimes we need to just mow down a few objections, you know? And there's a kind of natural clearing of the path that will bring about. And so people can begin to reconsider God and the things of God more deeply. Not that it's all about nature. Of course, they're going to need to have faith at some point to understand the supernatural mysteries. But there's a way in which the objections are the first thing to take care of sometimes. And by the way, this is why I think it can be helpful to actually begin conversations about religion with simply talking about God. Because people feel threatened by what they perceive as a merely human institution in religion. And moral teaching can feel like a condemnation of some kind, or a weird human power struggle. Unfortunately, people are often only interested in the Catholic faith because of what they know about its moral teachings and how strange it sounds to them. But everyone has a vested interest in how to live well, so these topics can be very sensitive and people can react to them very quickly. So it actually helps sometimes. Now, of course, we need to explain the whole eventually, but it can be helpful to actually begin with the question of God on a more speculative level and, you know, leave it to time for the other things to trickle down. And this leads me to tip number 6, give people time. We're not angels, and we can't see conclusions immediately. And as St. Thomas would have us know, that people need time to sift through arguments, to see their reasonability. And so sometimes we may feel like we're losing when we talk to people about God and they brush us off. But very often we've given them a lot to think about, and that's good. And they may just need time to chew on it, you know? So this is an important point to remember, that, you know, we can't expect people to see all of the conclusions overnight. That sometimes it really does just take not only consideration of the argument, but also perhaps just a few life experiences, for them to begin to reconsider or consider more seriously God and the things about God as related to Him. Tip number 7, encourage people to pray. Christian belief is a work of grace. And unfortunately, we tend to often think of the Christian faith as a merely human reality, but it's a truly divine one. It's divine and human. We need God's assistance to believe the mysteries of the faith. He's revealed Himself, but He also strengthens us from within through His grace. And people will even recognize this to a certain extent. when we introduce a mystery to them, you know, like the mystery of the Trinity, they'll say, this is, gets into the story about Fulton Sheen and Mortimer Adler. But people say, well, how am I supposed to believe that supernatural thing? Or how am I supposed to believe something so high and lofty that I can't see or experience? And we respond that it's a work of faith. And they say, well, I guess you have faith and I don't. You know, a lot of conversations die there. So I guess you just have faith and I don't. But, as that story illustrates, the grace of faith is free and available. And grace, of course, comes to us through the sacraments, but baptism infuses sanctifying grace, and the other sacraments increase grace within us. But grace, at least, at the very least, operative graces we need to make an act of faith are available to anyone who prays for them. So this is why it's important to encourage people to pray. While, yes, the practice of the faith is a much larger and comprehensive reality that someone needs to be introduced into, at the same time, there are basic moments of insight that someone can receive through the grace of God, even outside the practice of the sacraments. So we want to encourage people to pray. You know, we could probably even barter with someone and say, well, okay, the perfect prayer is going to be one that recognizes God is there and that he loves us and wants to reveal himself to us. But if someone's only willing to grant a little opening, you know, they're very hesitant even in their prayer. They might even seem very skeptical and reluctant. You say, well, at least pray that way. You know, God, I don't know much about you, but I want to pray, and I'm asking you to show me something. I'm asking you to show me the truth. And if we give someone, if someone gives God just that little opening, it's a way that they can begin to cultivate a relationship with him. And it's amazing the graces he pours out on an open heart like that. Tip number 8, give people the whole picture, or don't be afraid to give people the whole picture. So I've stressed at the very beginning that we need to begin with common ground in talking to people about God. And this is true, but we shouldn't feel trapped in by common ground. And here's what I mean. The Catholic faith isn't like a video game where you can only go on to another level once you've completed the earlier one. It's more like a book. And if you're like me, as soon as you pick up a book, you go to the table of contents. And if it's a European book, you're struggling finding the table of contents, and it's in the back all of a sudden. I don't know why. But you can see the overview. You know, it tells you a lot about a book by just reading the topics in the table of contents. And we ought to be able to present the Catholic faith a bit more like a book than a video game. That we can give people an overview, and that in a way they may be more moved by the intelligibility, the plausibility of the whole of the faith, more so than by carefully constructing one argument for them after another. Because again, I think people might be skeptical and see in the presentation of one little argument after another a kind of human device at work. But oftentimes, especially certain types of people, can be moved by the beauty and the intelligibility of the whole. And this strategy may be more effective for those whose personality makes them more attracted to beauty than to truth. Of course, you know, I think our St. Thomas's Metaphysics would affirm that truth and beauty find their ultimate unity in God. So we've got that great poem on the Grecian urn, Truth is Beauty and Beauty Truth, very familiar in kind of the English literature scene. But there's a profound metaphysical truth to it as well. And you know, maybe there's some people who respond to beauty a little bit more instinctually than they do to truth, and that's fine. These are for the Sebastian Flights of the world. If you're familiar with the book Brideshead Revisited, you'll sort of know what I mean. If you're not, it's a great novel. I think everyone should read. Lots of important Catholic themes and conversion and everything present in it. But at one point, there's the two main characters having a conversation, and Charles, the agnostic skeptic, challenges Sebastian, the devout, at least raised a devout Catholic, on his beliefs. He says, oh, well, isn't it such a chore to have to go to Mass every Sunday and to believe all of those fanciful, beautiful things about the mysteries, and do you really believe all that beautiful nonsense? And Sebastian says, oh, I believe it because it's beautiful. And that wouldn't be St. Thomas's response. But there's a way in which we can interpret it. It says, you know, there might be something to that. It says, when we behold the intelligibility of the whole ensemble of the faith, it can be very moving. So you can give people the whole picture, the whole story of creation and salvation and our part in it. That God exists, that he created the world, we sinned, he became man, died for our sins, and rose again, and now he's working on us and drawing us to himself. And by doing this, it's true that you'll be moving far beyond what can be known by reason alone. But I think when most people tell you about their conversion, it's not a matter of progressing from one argument to another, or even from believing one supernatural mystery and then another and then another and then another in a logical sequence. It's more a matter of having a penetrating insight into a few key truths. And then the rest of the faith almost fell into place for them. You can hear people say this in their stories. Say, I realized God loved me, or I realized Jesus died for my sins, or I realized Jesus is God, and he's truly present in the Eucharist. This is truly a work of grace, but there's a way in which just a few central foundation stones falling into place can lead people to a profound openness to the whole. If we stay merely within the bounds of what someone accepts and only introduce one rational argument after another, the faith may appear only as a blueprint or a sketch, and not a beautiful and vibrant masterpiece, as it truly is. So that was the eighth tip. Now I just want to sort of draw things to a close in light of the first lecture. I began by mentioning that believers seem to be up against a mountain of difficulties when it comes to even just talking to people about God, because atheism or agnosticism seem like the default. Our culture claims that man is not naturally religious. But there's a general hostility towards religion as well. And when believers turn and try to express their convictions, they may feel very limited in what tools they can use. We really are often so timid, so afraid of even mentioning God. But if we consider it, we're actually in a better position than we expect. And I maintain we have the upper ground. We have the truth on our side, or rather, we are on the side of truth. There's a natural desire for God implanted in us, and at least a vague notion of God as our final happiness. And furthermore, human beings, as rational animals, have the ability to seek out causes and the curiosity that leads them to do so. And God is the first cause of all things, and he can be discovered through his effects. In fact, we can learn a great deal about him through reason alone, following the guidance of Aquinas. But if someone doesn't have the aptitude or time to go down the philosophical route, the grace of faith is able to make up for all of this in an instant. And everyone is called to forge a relationship of faith with the one true God. So even if faith and reason seem like a strange pair at first, they are actually the best of lights. They've both been given by God to lead us back to himself, who is the one ultimate truth. If you'll look at the chart, just as a way to conclude, it's very important to see. I've given you, even beyond faith, that row number 5. This is kind of where I want to leave you. That ultimate way of knowing, through the light of glory. The light of glory is what St. Thomas calls, using the language of the scriptures, that very joining of our minds to God in heaven in the beatific vision. It's not some third light. It's really a way of describing the intimate and profound relationship forged between the soul and God through the beatific vision. And so, what will we know in heaven? Well, most importantly, we'll have a direct vision of God face to face. According to the language of St. John, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. Only God sees God as he is. And only God can bring us to see him as he is. And then, of course, our knowledge of all other things will be fulfilled, that we'll know things in the Word. So our desire for simplicity and unity will be fulfilled in heaven, in seeing God face to face and beholding all things in his light. Thank you. So we have some time for questions.
You touched on this briefly in tip number 5. Mm-hmm. A lot of what we talked about kind of a rational discussion, but you can often encounter people who are incredibly irrational.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you experience that more as a religious wearing the habit, but like, how in those conversations where it's going to be very difficult to even like have a reasonable conversation, what can we do to best, I guess, kind of promote a good image of God, but also like recognize there's a, you're not going to be able to rationalize it crazy.
That's an excellent point. Thank you. And in a way, that's really the would be an important theme to cover in another lecture. I'm not just punting here because I am going to say something to address your question. But it's something: how do we even bring the discussion to a rational level or to the level of argument? I like Alistair MacIntyre's diagnosis of our culture as being rife with emotivism. So, well, what is emotivism? Well, it's when really the only way of expressing an argument is to say boo and yay, you know. It's as though we're just watching one big sporting event, you know. And so we never did this, but my friends and I wanted to make T-shirts that said, yay MacIntyre, boo emotivism. but we've brought it to the unfortunately a lot of people are only on the boo and yay level. And I think, you know, that's where it's important to actually cultivate a friendship with someone. You know, ideally, these are the. I guess I didn't exactly situate a context. I'm leaving it somewhat to your own imagination. Who are the people in my life that I could even begin to talk to about God? Who are the people that need to hear about God? Because part of the authenticity of our message is seen in that we actually establish a relationship first. You know, and I think once someone trusts us and is willing to at least listen to us, and that could be a stranger, that could be in the course of a single instance. Once someone's willing to listen to us, we can actually begin to gain some ground. You know, exactly when you introduce, discussion of God. Frankly, I'm charmed by your mention of how we wearing the habit might get a fair amount of criticism. I'm continually surprised how open people are and how wearing the habit, in fact, is a way to even begin the discussion. And people come and they talk to me about God, you know. And it's like, and not just, you know, devout people who want to talk to a priest, but people who, it's funny, you know, it's funny what kind of vocabulary the secularity of the culture has left people with. People come to, oh, I just want to thank you for believing strongly in something. You know, it's like, people will say that. People will say that. Yeah. Yeah. So, I think that there's a part of, you know, what I'm doing in introducing this discussion of human nature's capacity to know about God is to say, well, actually, it's in there. Even if it's clouded, even if it seems like this is going to be someone very difficult to ever discuss God with, saying they are the type of thing destined to know God. And so, especially if God has arranged creation in such a way, and providence, and the church in such a way that I can play a role in that, well, here I am, Lord.
Yeah, so you talk a lot about people who may be mind Catholic at all. What advice would you give in speaking to someone who is Catholic and likes being Catholic and grateful for that, but they kind of want to cherry pick parts of their faith and like live in that way? How do you, what advice would you give in talking to them about having like respectful arguments while still affirming the fact that they love their faith and that they're welcome and you're not second guessing their emotion?
That's an excellent question. Thank you. So the question is, how does one engage in discussion about God with other Catholics who may not be keen on all the teachings of the church? And it's, I like your language of cherry picking. I think this is what people often call cafeteria Catholicism. No, it's, ooh, I like this teaching. it's the a la carte experience of Catholicism. I think it's important to talk to people about the fact that belief forges a relationship, and that faith is a matter of having a relationship with God, who himself is truthful. You know, I gave some philosophical arguments how God is truth. But to cherry pick or to select certain teachings and omit others is really to undermine one's relationship with God, you know? Because you're saying, oh, well, you know, I think God is great, and he's really gotten most things right. If there's just a few things where, you know, I'm going to prefer my own opinion on. And, of course, we trust the church as God's chosen witness, you know, the apostolic tradition, that God not only revealed himself, but he revealed himself in such a way that the true revelation would be preserved and continually unfolded and illumined, you know, that it's... People get this idea that Christianity is some kind of secret religion, or, you know, or that Catholicism has all of these mysterious things. It's like, well, actually, God has revealed himself, which of its very nature is about showing everyone something. Yes, it can be involved. It's not something we can explain necessarily all in one conversation. But it is a matter of being open. This is, you know, Dominicans, this goes to like the core of the Dominican heart, because St. Dominic preached against the Albigensians, who, in addition to have a very strange view of human nature and God, also were a kind of Gnostic religion in the terms of being secret truths only available to certain people. Whereas what we propose as Catholics is something available to all. I've now really wandered from your question. I'm very sorry. Getting back to your point about how to talk to other Catholics. Well, I think it's key to insist on the relationship forged with God through belief. We're talking about God elevating our minds to know what he wants us to know about himself. And this is where people often like to distance the church from Jesus. It's like, well, Jesus and I over here, we have a very special relationship, but there's a lot of bureaucracy over there that's just getting in the way. You know, that's the wrong way to, you know, think of how much language we use about the mystical body of Christ. The church is a living organism, you know, and focusing on the role of Christ in the church, especially through the Eucharist. That's, you know, important kind of way you might take it. But yes, that's an excellent question. Thank you. Yes.
And something kind of backdooring into that is the people that I deal with that are searching or do believe in God, and they talk about like spirituality, mm-hmm. and some of them read a lot of books and are very well versed, mm-hmm. and also they deal with the doormat Jesus, like in terms of, you know, Jesus of compassion, loving, open, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Coming across people like that and trying to push them through up the ladder of mm-hmm. these categories. Mm-hmm. What would you suggest for that? Mm-hmm.
That's a great question. So the question is about how to move someone from a vague notion of religion and God to the fullness of truth. And so I think that's what, actually, you're reminding us that there are a lot of these people out there who are spiritual but not religious, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. No, that's excellent. And, I mean, there's various reasons, there's various arguments you could kind of use to sort of persuade them to see the importance of having the reality, the social reality of the faith. You know, I think if you had someone that described to both of those, you might say, oh, well, if it's about helping the poor and other people, well, why wouldn't your relationship to God also involve other people? I think the other key thing to insist is that God uses intermediaries, you know, and that he delights in doing so. And yes, it's true, he wants to establish a direct relationship with everyone, and he does, and he individually loves everyone. Christ died for everyone. But there's also a way in which he uses intermediaries. He has chosen people for particular tasks. And this even goes to kind of a deep philosophical point, and that is that God is so good that he doesn't want to just give good things to other people, that he also wants to give other people the ability, St. Thomas says, the dignity of being causes of goodness in others. He wants to communicate to us the dignity of being a cause. I mean, so you could draw an analogy. I'm just thinking on my feet here. But let's say, well, I mean, you don't have children and say, though, well, I think God's just going to take care of them on their own, you know, and they, I don't really, you know, who am I to get in the way? Well, so too in the supernatural life, you know. There are those who communicate to us truth. There are those who've learned more. There are those who maybe have a deeper relationship with God and who God has chosen to, well, and I think we can reflect, has put into our lives to show us something of himself, you know. And so that gets into the entire importance of having the living, breathing reality of the church, you know. So it's not long before we need to see, you know, the trouble is removing from someone's mind the negative connotation they might have to church as such or institutionalized religion as such. That's the other person in the waiting room who I said, oh, well, you can't knock a faith because of a few bad people, but I don't believe in any religion, you know. I think, honestly, if you press someone on these things, you know, again, gently, questioning, okay, what exactly is it? It may come back to a bad experience, or it may come back to just poor reasoning. And even by asking them, you're already helping them to reconsider, well, okay, what exactly is it? And of course, the importance, you can't underestimate the importance of your own personal witness, too, saying, well, there's an entire whole that I'm supported by, you know, that I'm drawn into God through the not only the social reality of the church, but the sacramental and spiritual reality of the church, that worshiping together as the body of Christ is very important for me, you know. That religion isn't in some ways, it's a way of conceding. Someone that claims to be spiritual, not religious, is conceding to the secular position that, oh, well, religion's really just a private reality, so you should keep quiet about it and only talk with God in silence. And just, well, here we are saying, yes, I talk with God in silence, but thank goodness we talk about God with each other. Oh, that's Catholic. Why don't we go ahead and end on that note? Thank you, Father Sebastian. So.